on our ability to draw entrepreneurs and job creators and the brilliant minds doing the most cutting-edge work to the state of Michigan. And that's what we so desperately need to be attracting here to Michigan.
And you write, I know in your recent column, you write, Republicans have gone back to support several social issues, and this is what you're talking about, that have made universities ongoing targets for this fiscal retribution during the budgetary process. Of course, you're talking about this Education Omnibus Act. But that it, with the public universities, it's you are stating, it sounds like, that the Republicans or even the right wing end are holding us back from, at least in this, with the Education Omnibus Act, helping our students.
Well, that's really true, you know, and it's interesting. I met with the governor right before the Education Omnibus budget bill came through the Senate, and I said, you know, I am really troubled by this anti-stem cell language in these bills, this anti-domestic partnership benefit language in these bills, also the intolerant language that gives people a conscientious objector to, you know, to keep them from getting counseling for students at universities. That was in these bills as well. And the governor told me he agreed with me, but yet he didn't roll up his sleeves and use the power of his office to ensure that that kind of intolerant language was not woven into the fabric of our priorities, which is our budget bill. And, you know, I'll just expand that a little bit because this week we are debating Medicaid expansion, something that the governor has endorsed. It helps 500,000 people in the state of Michigan. It will bring in hundreds of millions of dollars from the federal government. And this governor is in Israel as this vote teeters on one or two vote swing. So to have an opinion and to say you embrace something is one thing, but you've got to stand and fight to make it so, and that's what we desperately would like to see out of the governor's office on these progressive issues.
We're talking to Senator Gretchen Whitmer, from a Democratic leader from East Lansing. But you bring up something, Senator, that is really, it is so controversial with, obviously, quote, Obamacare and how they want to expand the Medicaid influence here in Michigan. And a lot of states are struggling with that. I mean, I was just talking to my brother who lives in Virginia, and they're struggling with how to incorporate, obviously, the Obamacare, the statute, or at least how they're going to implement it individually in each state, especially when it comes to Medicaid.
That's true, and there's no question that this is a massive policy change. But like the governor, you know, a Republican governor with whom I don't always see eye to eye, but he looked at this issue the same way I did, and you have to draw the conclusion that when you have an opportunity to help 500,000 people in the state of Michigan, the poor, the working poor, the sickest among us, this is an opportunity we can't not take. And it comes with hundreds of millions of dollars that will be infused into our health care system. You know, when I'm lucky enough that right now I have got a health care card, and when I go to the doctor, my health care is covered as a part of my job. But you know what? Even when you show up with that card, you're subsidizing all the uncompensated care there is. This will be a benefit even for people who are lucky enough to have that health care with your job. This is something that makes sense, not just for those people that will directly be served, but for all of us. It will alleviate the incredible cost of health care.
You know, one of the things that we talk about in the show is also helping people, many times who can't help themselves, or at least can't afford to have certain what people would really consider their basic right. And I don't want you to leave without talking about the Michigan 2020 plan, because I think that the free college tuition for Michigan high school graduates can be so important, and they do it in other countries. I just can't believe we can't figure out a way to do that here in Michigan.
You know, the key to really getting our state back on track, whether you talk to, you know, an economist like Lou Glaser, or you talk to people at our institutions of higher learning, or parents who are so worried about ensuring their kids get that education they need, the key is to have a concentration of talent. And that means to have more degree holders. Now, whether it's a four-year degree, or it's community college, or it's trade skills, these are really game changers. What we have seen in Kalamazoo, after the Kalamazoo Promise, where every kid who graduates from Kalamazoo Public Schools gets a full ride onto whatever schooling they go on to matriculate to, it has been a game changer for that city. Businesses are choosing to locate there. the K-12 system has gone up a notch because all of a sudden there's light at the end of the tunnel for all these students and families. They've raised their own taxes to fund a pre-K schooling program. I mean, it's really dramatically changed Kalamazoo. Right. We'd love to see that for every kid in the state of Michigan.
Of course, it gets to the back of how are we going to pay for it? I mean, I know it's estimated to cost, what, $1.8 billion for it. How are we going to pay for that in Michigan?
Well, the cost is $1.8 billion once you have 4 full years of kids in a 4-year university. And let's be honest, 4-year university isn't for everybody, and that's why we say that it could be used for community college or a trade skill. But the key is we have identified $35 billion worth of tax expenditures, and that's tax breaks for certain special interests that have gotten on the books over the years and never been scrutinized. If we could find 5% savings there, we could more than fully fund this program and ensure we've got the best educated workforce in the world. And business would note that, and they would come here from all over the world.
Well, it's always about closing loopholes to be able to gain more influence with this with our tax base. Well, we're talking to Senator Gretchen Whitmer, a Democratic leader from East Lansing. We want to thank you for coming to the show and let us know what happens with that Medicaid. I know you're going through that Medicaid expansion issue right now.
Will do. Thanks, Scott. Have a good one.
Take care. Bye-bye. You know, you want to get a hold of Senator Whitmer. One of the major things she talked about was that 2020 plan. I think that's a great idea to be able to have everybody in the state of Michigan who's a resident of the state of Michigan, talk about people that they're gonna flock here to be able to get a education, either a community college, junior college, to be able to go to get an associate degree or go to a public university. And they'll come up with different ways of how to do that. But to be able to get that to at least get down the cost of education, it's crazy here. And I think you should call and tell Senator what you think about that idea. She's the Democratic leader up in Lansing. When we come back, we're going to have a great interview. We're going to talk with a veteran who survived the Vietnam War, survived 5 years of POW camp, Robert Jones. So don't go away. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Stay tuned for your scot-free legal tip of the day, sponsored by Courtside Radio on 1130 WDFN, The Fan.
After Sergeant Matthew Kyle was injured in Iraq, his young wife Tracy faced the daunting task of getting their VA benefits.
There's a lot of red tape, there's a lot of confusion, there's a lot of forms to fill out.
For years, paralyzed veterans trained experts have helped injured veterans and their families. National Service Officer Bobby Hager explains.
We're able to fill out all of the forms and applications and ask for all of the benefits that that veteran's entitled to.
To help, visit pva.org.
Hi, I'm attorney Scott Weinberg, and here's your scot-free legal tip of the day. Drunk driving. It's politically incorrect. It's killing people. And yet, it still happens here in the state of Michigan every single day. Why do people get behind the wheel of a vehicle after they've had too much to drink? Should we have breathalyzers in every bar before we leave? Should every car be fitted with a breathalyzer called an interlock device so that we have to blow into it before we start up the vehicle? Back in 2010, Michigan passed a law called Super Drunk Driving, which says that if you have 0.17 blood to alcohol content in your system, when you're operating a vehicle, you will lose your license and only get it back with these interlock breath devices in your car for the better part of a year. So, tip of the day. If you're driving to the bar, drink responsibly. And if you have any questions on how the drunk driving laws affect you or your family, call us at 800-7100-LAW before it's too late. I'm attorney Scott Weinberg with your scot-free legal tip of the day.
He would come home after a hard day and just start in on me, you know, like, hey, how's your day? How was school? What you got going on? I mean, it gave me the chills.
The time I got this wicked cool scorpion tattoo on my shoulder, not even the whole arm, just the shoulder. And he grounded me for 2 weeks. 2 weeks! And oh yeah.
Don't worry. They'll appreciate it. Eventually. A message from the National Fatherhood Initiative and the Ad Council. Have you been a dad today? For more information, visit fatherhood.org.
Let's rejoin the Courtside Radio Show with your host, attorney Scott Weinberg.
We're here with Robert Jones now, West Point graduate, Vietnam veteran, POW for more than 5 years. And we'll talk about that. And CEO of Veteran Sourcing Group, a wonderful organization helping veterans when they get back to their private lives. First of all, Mr. Jones, thank you for your service.
You're welcome.
Thank you. You know, we are here and we talk a lot on this show with veterans and heroes, too. And we're always so curious about what was it like when you first went to Vietnam. Were the men that are gone over there and they're sent over there, are they conscious about the possibility of being captured?
Well, first of all, I was flying out of Thailand. In the Air Force, we were based in Thailand, flying our missions over North Vietnam. So I never was really in South Vietnam, but amongst us in the Air Force as pilots, of course, I was 24 years old, and when you're young like that, you're bulletproof and you're invincible. So I don't think any one of us really thought much about the possibility of being shot down or captured or even killed. So, I mean, it was like that kind of thing didn't happen to you or happen to me. It would happen to someone else.
And so where were you actually shot down?
I was shot down on a bombing mission over Hanoi. It was a power plant, a Bac Gang power plant. It's a little to the south west of Hanoi, and this is on 18 January 1968.
And you were there 5 years.
I was there for 62 months, and one of the it was amazing to me because when I was shot down and when I got there, there were guys that were already there for almost 3 years. So that was like a shot to the heart, because it was just natural when you were shot down. Everyone thought, well, I'm going to be the last guy shot down, and we're going to go home in a few months, and the war is going to be over. So when I found out there were guys there for two and almost 3 years, you think, well, man, maybe I'll be here for that long. So that was kind of a hard pill to swallow.
It's an amazing thing. I mean, especially people that have never been over in a war zone area, let alone captured. It's hard to conceive, and I've read, of course, books on it too, but until you're in that situation, I don't think anybody can really identify it with it.
Yeah, it's obviously, we live here in the United States, and we have all the freedoms and privileges and the rights, and you know, I mean, our country is obviously not perfect, but when you lose these things and when you lose your freedom, you're locked up. And when I was first there, I didn't see the sun for 3 months. And finally, one day, the guards took me out, and I just stood there and let the rays hit my body, and it was unbelievable. But when you lose those things, all of a sudden they become very, very valuable. And you know, we don't see that now, but not everywhere is as free as we are. There's no doubt about it.
What can you identify one of the most important things that got you through those 5 years?
Well, I was from a military background. I say a military background. I went to the West Point, and so there was obviously some military training there. But you know, a lot of it was just having faith that we wanted to go home. And of course, the Vietnamese told us, "We will try you, we will convict you, and we will execute you. You will never go home." And we didn't believe that. And I think most of us, really, in the end, we felt sorry for the Vietnamese, for the guards, and for the they were just really kids, peasant type kids that were guards for us. And I thought personally that I said, look, someday I'm going home, but you guys got to stay here. You
know? How were you liberated? How were you actually freed?
Well, it was the Paris talks, and that I guess were going on for probably a year or so in 72 or so, and Henry Kissinger was there, and some delegation from North Vietnam, South Vietnam, and I think there were some other parties involved. But in reality, the North Vietnamese were just coming in every day and reading a set statement and walking out. And it wasn't until President Nixon started the bombing again, B-52 bombing in 72, that they got the Vietnamese, North Vietnamese attention, and things became serious then. So I credit President Nixon, really. He was the one who brought us home.
When you got back home, and we always hear about the protests, of course, in the late 1960s and 70s, where It seems now people are, of course, so much more supportive of people coming back from Iraq and coming from foreign wars. But back, people forget, coming back from Vietnam, it was not the same situation. Did you feel that when you were coming back?
Well, yeah, I knew about it. And, you know, we were a little bit unique, I think, during that time period. And obviously, many of my classmates from West Point, like I said, I went into the Air Force, so became an Air Force pilot. But most of my classmates from West Point in 1965 obviously went into the Army. And when a lot of those folks came home, yeah, they saw the treatment that we read about now or witnessed, where you know, they weren't welcomed home by any means. And but for us, we came home and it was a little different. We were kind of welcomed home, and there was almost some a little bit of a celebrity status, which you know, I didn't really care for, but.
Because you were a POW?
Yeah, because we were POWs and we were there for a length of time, you know, years at a time. And so I didn't see much of any protests towards us, I mean, specifically the POWs. So personally, I didn't personally witness any of this treatment that many of the normal Army people got when they got home. So
You know, I know that you're involved, of course, with the veterans. We'll talk about that and helping veterans out. But one of the things, and I see it in, not only in my practice, and I'm involved with the sobriety courts and the veterans courts, mm-hmm. but how many soldiers come back from foreign wars with post-traumatic stress?
Absolutely.
And you would think that someone who is coming back, of course, as a former POW, that would be extreme. Well, did you face that? Were you treated
well,
for that?
Well, you know, I'm not saying that, that probably didn't happen, but, you know, there were only about 500 of us or so that came back. I mean, far less than... in World War II or Korea or any other major war, we were just a fraction of the number of POWs in Vietnam. And so, and another thing, there was only one way you could be a POW in Vietnam, and that was be shot down. And because we had no ground troops on the ground in North Vietnam. So, and in order to be a shot down, you had to be a pilot. And to be a pilot, most cases you went to college and you know, you're an officer, and so you're a little bit older than the average, I'd say. Army kid in World War II or Korea or even Vietnam. So we were a little bit older, so I don't think maybe we weren't exposed or there wasn't much of that I saw. I mean, we were just so happy to be home, and yet I can't say that there wasn't some of us, and I don't know of any cases personally that of guys that didn't go through this. Me personally, my life was pretty much the same when I came home. I wasn't married, so I stepped right back into almost where I left. So,
did you stay friends, or did you keep in contact with ones that you actually were a prisoner of war with?
Absolutely. Or, I mean, we just had a reunion here about a month ago. It was our 40th reunion, if you can believe it, of coming home. We came home in 73, and President Nixon at that time in 73 had a huge party at the White House. And it was it was so many of us, they had put up a large tent right on the White House lawn. And I'm told it's the largest party even today, to this day, that they've ever had at the White House. So in honor of that, 40 years exactly to the day later, the Nixon Library has just thrown which I attended in May last month, a huge party there too. So.
Well, that's great. Where is that, in California?
It was in Yorba Linda, California, right?
Yeah.
So, but as far as keep in touch with, we have reunions all the time, and some of my closest friends, obviously, were in jail with me.
Well, that's tremendous that you've kept contact like that. Of course, you know, the one that we hear about most, just because he's the Senator McCain,
right.
And his plight and what he went through and coming back. But you don't really hear him talking about some of the things that I see in court, which is the post-traumatic stress syndrome, which it just seems like that would be a part of any POW's life coming back. But maybe they just didn't treat it the way they treat it now.
That's possible. I mean, I don't think I even heard of that term until, you know, recently.
Right.
And so that wasn't a term that was thrown around when we got back 40 years ago. But, you know, I'm sure some people had trouble adjusting, and maybe that's what it was. But McCain, McCain was a tough guy. There's no doubt about it. He broke 3 out of 4 limbs when he jumped out of his airplane, and... he almost died. He went into a lake and was saved by a Vietnamese fisherman. And And they actually wanted him to go home early because of his father. His father was father was an admiral. He was SINCPAC, Commander in Chief Pacific. And so they found out who he was. They wanted him to go home early as a propaganda issue, and he wouldn't do it. So they actually tortured him to try to make him go home, and he wouldn't do it. So
that's an incredible story.
I give credit for that. Yeah.
Now you, of course, now are involved with helping veterans once they come back, and you have two different companies, right? You have the West Point Services. Tell us about that.
Exactly. West Point Services is a company. It's because I have a disability rating, I have created a company which is known as an SDVOSB, which is a service-disabled, veteran-owned small business. And as such, we have access to certain contracts that are called set-aside contracts from the VA, Department of the Army, or other such organizations, government organizations, where they're trying to diversify the people, the companies that are involved with the government. And so they offer these contracts strictly to these type companies. So what we're trying to do is create housing situations and service areas and just trying to help veterans. Mainly, a lot of it is trying to get homeless veterans off the street.
You know, I was just actually having the conversation with our producer actually today, where we were coming out of Detroit, and we both saw that there is a much larger percentage, at least it seems like, of people with homeless signs that say former vet.
Right.
It is in my mind one of the saddest things
coming
out of simply the city of Detroit.
Absolutely. And so I mentioned that I was a 65 graduate from West Point. Well, another one of my classmates is Secretary Shinseki.
Oh, is that right?
Yes, absolutely. He was a four-star general and chief of staff of the Army, and he is the Secretary of the Veterans Affairs now. So I've spoken with him, and he's on board with this. And of course, I think he's issued a mandate. Hopefully, that we can carry out of getting, I think by the end of 2015, to get all the any homeless veteran off the street.
And being in this area too, and there's we're just coming back, of course, with high unemployment, trying to bring it down, trying to bring just the city of Detroit, but manufacturing here in Michigan. That we want to be able to get our local businesses to want to hire veterans.
Right.
And one of it is also, and this is what we've talked about with General Stone before too, is getting veterans retrained, getting them with service or at least in trade skills that are acceptable by local businesses.
Exactly. Well, this other company that I'm involved with, Veteran Sourcing Group, is leans more towards that, and although I really think that that both companies can intermesh here, but Veteran Sourcing Group, what we do right now, we're teamed with another company in New York that is a basically an IT company, and this company has a domestic outsourcing training facility in Pennsylvania, and what we've been doing with Veteran Sourcing Group is contacting and working with Wall Street type firms, banks, whatever. And of course, most of these companies are outsourcing jobs to, you get on the phone and you talk to somebody and he's in the Philippines or India or somewhere else. And what we're saying is, listen, why don't we take some of these jobs that you're outsourcing to other countries, let's bring some of them back on shore. And believe right now, I mean, before it was very, it was economical, much more economical and cheaper to do it overseas. But now the prices are coming closer to being equal. So let's bring some of these jobs that you're outsourcing back on shore, and let's give them to veterans.
Are there many companies that do that actually source out to
Absolutely.
Veterans and hire?
Because
that's really what we would need. I mean,
Absolutely.
To focus on that, to get veterans to come
there's
work.
There's thousands of jobs that are going offshore now. Absolutely. And so, I can't blame these companies because in the past it was much cheaper to do it, and the foreign labor markets and everything involved. But now there's issues of quality control, and it's, a lot of these countries are their standards of living are going up, and so the prices are getting closer and closer to what we can do on shore. And so there's been a big push, and all these companies have diversity requirements that they want to meet. And this qualifies
right.
for that.
So. Right. We're talking to Robert Jones, West Point graduate, Vietnam veteran. Now, you're here in Michigan. You were at the Robert Arvin Foundation.
Yeah, Bob Arvin is is our classmate.
And you got to speak at that.
I did. Yeah, I did.
Now, what is that foundation about?
Well, Bob Arvin was in my class at West Point, and he was from Ypsilanti, Michigan. And he was an absolute superstar. I mean, there's nothing in high school that he didn't do. Valedictorian, class president, student council president, Eagle Scout. I mean, you name it, he did it. And at West Point, it was the same thing. He was what we call the first captain of cadets, which is a brigade commander. He was the number one cadet at West Point. And he was captain of the wrestling team there, as he was in high school. He graduated high in the class academically. I mean, he was a superstar. And went to Vietnam. He was an airborne ranger. He was the youngest captain, commander of a company in the 82nd Airborne. He was, unfortunately, was killed. He was only, I think, 25 years old.
Was he killed in Vietnam?
He was killed in Vietnam, yes. And he received 2 Silver Stars, the Purple Heart, and along with a lot of other awards and decorations. And, you know, they named a VFW post after him here in Ypsilanti. And they've created a foundation for Bob where they give a scholarship. And they've been doing this for, I think, about 10 years. And it's, you know, it's just not a huge thing. I think it's only $1,000. But they give 10 scholarships each year to deserving high school seniors from the area. And they have to apply for it. And so I was asked to come and speak at the dinner, at the foundation dinner that they hold every year this year. And it was really, and I was honored to do it. And I'll tell you, these kids that received these awards were, they're superstar kids, too. I mean, most of them had full ride scholarships to different colleges and
Are they going into the service themselves?
No, not right away. They're going to college first. Yeah. So they were all bound for college. And but these kids were all the highest level kids too, boys and girls. So,
what do you think about involuntary service? We were just having this discussion about where, of course, there's countries that don't have a volunteer military. They're indoctrinated and they're sent in, like Israel, and
sure,
they have no choice. Do you think we should have that here?
Well, you know, that's a debatable question. You know, I'm kind of my background is mainly the military, and my feeling is, you know, the military was good for me, and I think that for most, it's not for everyone, but I think for probably the majority of kids growing up in this country, maybe a little structure like the military wouldn't be a bad idea. And so I don't know whether that would have to be a draft or something. I'm not saying that, but maybe some type of service that maybe everyone would have to perform, whether it's military or some type of other national service, then that would create a little patriotism and you know, and love of country, that type of thing. We take a lot of things for granted here. We really do.
That's really true. It's one of it's the greatest country in the world. Well, Bob Jones, we want to thank you for coming on the show, and please come back again.
My pleasure.
Come back from Hawaii. I know it's tough to come from Hawaii here to Michigan.
Thank you very much.
But we appreciate it. Thank you very much.
That was Bob Jones. An incredible story, wasn't it? Incredible. Our Vietnam veteran, POW for over 5 years. Than a pilot here. He didn't get into it, but he's also an attorney. But I can't imagine what that must have been like to come out of 5 years of captivity and coming back into the United States and to a whole public that I don't think back then they really were accepting. It's not like now where we have our military and they come back. And, of course, we try to open up our arms and accept them back. But I tell you, that is true with the homeless. If we ever see a homeless vet, you go up and you actually give them something. I don't care if it's a hamburger or it's a dollar. You try to take care of them. And I've been trying to do that for some time now. But it's just a shame that we have homeless military veterans back here in this country. So whenever you see someone, even if it's not a homeless guy, it's a military vet, you go thank them for their service. You go buy them lunch. You go help them out. You know what you can do is just have a conversation with them. It's amazing, amazing the stories that they have. Just a guy that you meet at a restaurant. We always try to support the veterans here on Courtside Radio. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Join us next week for the Courtside Radio Show with your host, Attorney Scott Weinberg.
Case dismissed.